Hi, I'm Vidit, the founder and host of this podcast, The High Flyers.
Hey, Vidit, I'm Chris Wurissenhart, the CEO and co-founder of Linkby.
Chris, I am pumped for this, or should I say Kishan, as I discovered it in the research.
What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey, friends, welcome back, or welcome to The High Flyers podcast, where we do reimagine a high flyer, showcase the brightest and most relatable role models and companies and their journey from sunrise to today. As one of the premier products in our Curiosity Center lineup, providing on-demand intelligence to help you be 1% better every single day. I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal, and let's have some fun.
Our listeners have called this podcast a meticulously researched biography unveiling the extraordinary lives and decisions of the most remarkable individuals and companies from around the world. We hope you're enjoying our catalog of 200-plus episodes. Since we launched 5 years ago in 2020, with many of our guests appearing in rare public interviews, it's now time to explore your curiosity. Please enjoy.
Let's start with our fun facts to get us going. Where were you born and where do you live now?
So, yeah, I was born in the UK, in just outside of London, and then we moved to Australia when I was 5 years old, and I've pretty much lived in Sydney, Australia ever since then.
And work, what was your first job and what do you do now?
So my first job was actually when I was a teenager. I worked in a newsagent, so I was kind of surrounded by newspapers, magazines and content, and turns out that nothing much has changed. Linkby is very much about kind of connecting brands with to be featured in publisher environments, newsletters, with content creators. And so I guess in some ways I'm still doing the same thing that I was when I was a teenager.
I like it. And Chris, as you know, the purpose of this show is to reimagine a high flyer. Is there a high flyer who you feel hasn't got the recognition they deserve?
Yeah, there's a few people that I think should get more recognition. I mean, I think that they've had a little bit of recognition. They did have an Australian story done on them, but I think within their kind of entrepreneurial circles, they maybe don't. And that's Sean Christie David from Played It Forward. I think Sean gets, he does get a bit of coverage, but you know, I think what he's doing is just so excellent in the hospitality space, creating opportunities for people, feeding people with kind of meals and things like that, as well as just kind of building some really cool hospitality spaces. Other than that, I was going to say maybe Richard Garfield, who's the founder and creator of Magic the Gathering, the card game, which is a game I'm obsessed with. And he did that way back in the 90s, but I guess, and they sell like $1 billion worth of product now every single year. And I feel like most people probably would never have heard of the name or may not even know anything about the product.
I have not heard of that product, so maybe you can tell us. And Sean is actually a friend and a previous guest in this podcast and a wonderful human. I actually was at one of his restaurants 2 weekends ago, Colombo Social, and big fan of Sean.
Yeah, 100%. Sean gets coverage, but I think that just what he's doing is so amazing that everyone should know about it.
Tell me about the card game. What's the TLDR?
It was like the first collectible trading card game. So it really influenced things like Pokemon and everything else in that kind of genre. It was founded and created in the early 90s and it's still going strong today. It's sort of like a strategy-based card game. A lot of people around sort of like tech and entrepreneurship, I think, crossover. There's always, whenever I talk about it, there's always people who come out of the woodwork and go, I play, or like I used to play. So there's something I think about a founder mindset and maybe strategizing and thinking about kind of what's your next move and how do you work with the resources that you have at hand that kind of go hand in hand with that particular product. And yeah, now it's probably at its strongest ever. They've done collaborations and crossovers with a whole lot of other IP and they sell like $1 billion of product every year.
I feel like after you've described it, I have played it, but the name doesn't ring a bell, but the description does ring a bell. So hopefully I've played it. But yeah, big fan of board games, and that sounds like a good one. Let's wind back the clock and go back to your sunrise, as I call it, your childhood. You talked about growing up, or you're born in the UK and then you moved to Sydney when you were 5, if I heard correctly. What are your memories of childhood and particularly influence of family and the environment?
Yeah, I think that most of my memories are probably from that sort of early period in Australia. And I think there was this huge sort of culture shock of maybe being the like little brown kid in often classes and schools where there was like predominantly everyone was white. I think that kind of cultural, like not quite knowing where I fit and trying to really sort of, yeah, make my mark, but also not quite knowing what it meant to be who I was in the kind of the broader culture was something that I think was interesting. Yeah, that's kind of like a lot of what my early memories are sort of kind of around. But, you know, it was like a happy childhood, lots of friends, whatnot. You know, I think I was always just trying to be that the smart academic kid who was winning the awards and things like that. And I don't know if that's something that's sort of created a bit of my competitive spirit, which definitely still exists today. But yeah.
You talked about Sean. I feel like Sean and I talked about this on the podcast when he came on. It's similar. I think his Sri Lankan heritage was I'm Indian heritage. And we talked about like identity and what it means. And I think we both agreed that as we get older, we're more proud of our heritage, but also more appreciative of it. Whereas kids, similar to you, I think I tried very hard to be someone else. And even I think he was joking about the lunchbox where his mum would give him like Sri Lankan food and he'd throw it away and he'd get like a sandwich or a wrap because he tried to fit in. I don't know if you've got any funny stories like that from like childhood or trying to fit in.
100%. Yeah. I mean, my mum used to make me like curried beef sandwiches. And so I would then trade with a friend who would get, it was basically like chicken linguine pesto sandwiches, very much just like leftover chicken pasta in the middle of a sandwich, which is like carbs in between carbs. But I thought they were great because they were different to what I was having. And he thought my sandwiches were great because like he's not having beef curry at night. We would sort of swap there. And yeah, I mean, as you said at the start of the podcast, my full name's Krishan. I think when I went to school, I sort of anglicized it to Chris. Now, like some of my friends call me Krishan, some call me Chris. I'd probably be pretty happy if everyone called me Krishan because it would just help you stand out. And I think, yeah, when you're younger, especially in a kind of predominantly sort of white environment at the time, just having brown skin made you stand out. And when you're a kid, often you just want to fit in. Whereas as you sort of grow up and you get older, you start to realize that standing out can be something that can really help you. And it's cool to be different and it's cool to have your own sort of story. So yeah, I think I've kind of come full circle on it as well. And I've got like a crew of kind of friends who are sort of founders and doing interesting things who kind of come from diverse backgrounds. And yeah, it's cool to kind of get together and yeah, talk about some of those like shared experiences.
I think you're telling me about the WhatsApp group. You guys have a WhatsApp group, right? And there's like a token non-brown guy in there or something.
Well, no, it's predominantly, it's all Sri Lankan guys, including Sean actually, but then also there's one guy from an African-American background who's a token Sri Lankan, I suppose. but the name of the chat group is Fear of a Brown Planet, so.
So wait, did you and Sean go to school together?
No, so me and Sean's cousin, Sean, who was also called Sean, is
right.
Sorry, right, we're good right. friends, and so I met Sean through his cousin, Sean.
Okay, got it. And parents, tell me what your parents did for work.
Yeah, so my parents are both chartered accountants by trade. Dad then went on and sort of had a number of kind of roles within accounting and then worked his way up to where he was in the UK. He was the sort of like the chief financial officer of a sort of an early computer company that they sort of that failed, but then they did a management buyout of and sort of, I think, listed it on the stock exchange. And it was a pretty wild journey. So my dad was always kind of, he's had a bit of an entrepreneurial streak within him where like he's kind of done some interesting things in business and whatnot. And my mum's always kind of been a great support to my dad, has worked in some of my dad's businesses over the years and is a chartered accountant. So definitely kind of quite different from the space that I've kind of gone into. I managed to avoid the accountancy thing, but yeah, that was their background.
I can't picture you as an accountant. I cannot see you in an accounting firm. So I'm curious, how do you think the parts separated both the entrepreneurship part, but even your interest areas, right? Whether it's culture or fashion or some of the other things we'll chat about. Can you, when you reflect back on that, what do you think was the source of your interests?
Yeah, look, I think I've always been interested in culture, I think, and kind of music and, yeah, maybe to some degree fashion and whatnot. I remember getting my first ever cassette tape and sitting there and putting it in and listening to the music and reading the lyrics and kind of like just being quite moved by that experience. And when I was in my teens and early 20s, I played in bands and we would sort of tour down to kind of Melbourne and play shows around the local sort of music venues in Sydney and whatnot. I loved going to op shops and thrift shops when I was kind of a teenager and growing up. And I think for me, it all comes down to this maybe that sense of identity and finding kind of more of who you are in all of those things and being able to express more of who you are through those things is potentially why I was kind of drawn to it. And so then I think I was always a little bit, and even kind of from a kind of entrepreneurship sort of standpoint, I was always the kid who had the little schemes to kind of money-making schemes at school and would sell things and whatnot. And I think I always wanted to channel that into something that was aligned with all those cultural interests that I had. And so I remember looking up to businesses, I suppose this is going back to the late 90s, early 2000s, like fashion businesses like Subi and Sass & Bide, and looking at what they were doing and going, wow, like you can make money doing like cool, interesting things. Or there was a record label called Modular Records that released lots of like very influential Australian music in the early 2000s. And I remember being like, wow, imagine like being able to kind of create a career off of making kind of music and records. Wouldn't that be sort of the best? And so I think that kind of very much influenced my path in my first startup, Pedestrian. So yeah, I think that's how it all sort of maybe comes together to some degree.
Yeah, it's always hard in reflection to connect the dots directly, but I think they somehow connect. And both you and I talked, reflected on our identities, but the common thread in my research was you've got enormous self-belief. And I think I'm the same, where people often wonder that, like, how does a brand guy have so much self-belief? If my parents, and I always say it comes from my mum, like my mum's a dreamer and she always said to me, she's like, you put your mind to it, you can do it. And for me, it comes from my mum. I'm curious, like, where does your self-belief come from, if ever, if there's a source?
Yeah, I'd say my mum's been pretty influential in that. My mum's always, she's fiercely biased towards her kind of children and her grandkids. She's always, we sort of joke about it, but we'll go to some performance with one of the kids and she'll be like, oh, I just think that, you know, about my son, he's just the most handsome and he's the tallest. And, you know, about our daughter, oh, she's the prettiest and she's the this and that. And so I guess my mum was very much, I guess, filled us with a lot of confidence in who we were and our abilities. And I think if you know that you've got that sort of person who just like completely loves you unconditionally, it helps you to then go and take risks because you've got that sort of fallback. I think there was a few influential people along the way as well. In my kind of formative years, there was a year five teacher I had called Mr. Hines, who just was really kind of unlocked. I think before kind of his class, I was sort of this shy kid that was sort of working out who I was. And then he really kind of built up my sort of confidence and let me kind of get outside my shell a bit. Like he was just very supportive of everything that I wanted to do and would stick things up on the wall and would just kind of keep pushing me to kind of keep creating and doing interesting things. So yeah, look, I think there's people like that along the way that definitely kind of make you, yeah, put you on that path and help to build that sort of confidence that sort of still exists today.
Back to the episode in a moment. I am joined today by Dom Anderson, partner at Allens. Hey, Dom.
Hey, Vidit. Thanks very much for having me.
I'm excited to have you on. I believe today we are talking about equity incentives for maturing companies. How are you seeing growth companies think about incentive schemes and what are some of the considerations you're seeing executive teams implement?
Thanks, Vidit. So I think from my perspective, savvy startups and investors really view employee equity incentives not just as a form of cash-free compensation, but really as a strategic asset. Founders should ensure their incentive plans are appropriately sized in terms of both individual grants and also the available pool overall. And they should be thinking about incentives, I guess, not just as a recruitment tool, but really asking, how can I ensure retention? From my perspective, from a legal perspective, I think there are three things that founders should focus on. First, adopt structures and documentation that ensure employees get the best tax outcomes. And that part's obviously critical for both the individual, but also for the startup. Second thing is to ensure that grants can be made in compliance with Australia's securities law requirements, and that can be really tricky to navigate. Finally, plan ahead in terms of cap table management. Things can get really tricky really quickly if you've got lots of former employees that hold shares in the company, for example.
And I know you work with a lot of startups at various stages. As companies mature, should they be thinking differently about their incentive structures?
Yeah, so Vidit, I guess in the early days, lots of startups that we work with will adopt a simple one-size-fits-all approach. And that's generally intended to get the benefits of Australia's startup tax concessions, which is a really effective and helpful regime if it's available. But as companies mature, for example, companies no longer able to avail themselves of the ATO's concessions, they do need to start thinking about other structures. And that's really where we start to get a bit creative. It's where we start to ask questions about whether there's a need to split incentive plans into different, more tailored structures, for example. Economically, we might think about whether there's still the potential for sustained growth in the value of the company. And the answers to those questions, among others, will dictate the most appropriate structure to adopt. And that will look very different in different circumstances. So, for example, you might think about structures like zero-priced option plans, premium price plans, loan-funded plans, flowering share plans, for example. And they're all structures that might be on the table. The key, of course, is to get advice from the experts and to be flexible.
Yeah, fascinating topic. Well, Dom, we'll leave it at that. But now back to the episode.
That was Dom Anderson, partner at the law firm Allens, one of our amazing sponsors on this podcast. To find out more about Allens and their services, head to allens.com.au. And now back to this episode with Chris from Linkby.
And tell me, age 18, what was fulfillment at that age? What did you think you wanted to do with life?
I think I knew I wanted to do something like start my own thing at some point. I knew I was really interested in the sort of advertising, marketing kind of media world. To me, that sort of felt like the point, and even publishing probably to some degree around that time, it felt like the point at which creativity and business came together, having that founder mentality and wanting to go out there and make money and do those things and be financially independent. I love that sort of the business side of things, but then all of those cultural and creative touch points and, you know, interests that I had, I didn't want to lose those. I didn't want to just be the finance guy who does some interesting stuff with his on the weekend. I really wanted my life to be bring all those things that I love together. Yeah, so that was probably the thing that I was kind of looking at when I was like 18. It was like, how do I bring this world of creativity that I love with entrepreneurship and business and whatnot?
Because you did go to university, right?
I did like a commerce degree at the University of New South Wales. And I think when I started, my dad was like, just do finance and accounting. They're the safe majors. You can pretty much do anything you want with those. And I like the good kind of child of an immigrant. I did. I went, and that's what I signed up for as my majors, even though I was like, oh, I really think I could be great at marketing, but, you know, I guess dad's probably right. So I chose those. And then after a few weeks, I was just like, nah, there's no way I could do the next 3 years doing this. And so I swapped out accounting for marketing, and I just loved all those subjects and worked so hard at them. And yeah, they just clicked for me. And I was like, I can be world class at this. And I remember telling my dad, I was like, I'm just going to be an average accountant, but I can be truly exceptional in this marketing world. Yeah.
And I believe this was early 2000s because you started Pedestrian in 2005, right?
Yeah, correct. University was 2001. So yeah, finished school in the year 2000. And yeah, Pedestrian, we started working on the idea in 2004 and then launched it.
So was that your first job out of uni, Pedestrian?
I had about a year's worth of work experience. So commerce was a three-year degree. I got a summer internship at Procter & Gamble, one of those kind of graduate roles that everyone tries to kind of line up. I did that for 4 or 5 months over the kind of summer. Typically, you get offered a job after that, and most of those roles are based in Singapore. I'd like to say that they offered me a role and I turned it down, but actually they didn't offer me a role. So I was one of the few grads that they didn't offer a full-time role to. I think most of the grads in our class got offered full-time roles and I did not.
You were just too good. You're just too good, Chris, clearly.
Well, I mean, I like hopefully they look back on that as a miss from their standpoint. But I mean, I think maybe it was just the way I don't think I'm a very good employee is something I learned in that year. I did that role. Then I worked at a media agency called the University of McCann, and I really enjoyed that job. I learned a lot. It really kind of helped build the foundation of understanding the world of sort of how media organizations essentially get funded through advertising. And that was hugely influential in kind of the Pedestrian journey. I also met my co-founder from Pedestrian, which is my first venture before Linkby, at sort of that job at University of McCann. And that role was incredible in terms of what I learned in that sort of 8 months. But yeah, so there was about a year's worth of work experience. And then I guess that confidence came into it. And I just went, well, you know, what more is there out there to learn? I can go sort of start my own thing. So yeah, so that's kind of what we did.
Let's double click on pedestrian as like the first chapter, the next chapter in your book. So you said 2004 when you started working on it. I think 2005 is when you officially launched it. Now, this was pre-Facebook, pre-the iPhone, pre-a lot of stuff that is staple today in the online world. Tell us about where the world was at and what was the opportunity that you were going after?
Yeah, 100%. So I think the opportunity, so I met my co-founder, Oscar, and he was similarly kind of entrepreneurially minded, and we were in this sort of period where we were seeing being in a media agency means all of the media companies come and pitch to you. So at the time, it was we were seeing radio stations being launched, and magazines being launched, and newspapers doing interesting things, and the early sort of websites starting to kind of come through the door, very early stages. And so we were like, wouldn't it be cool if we just ran our own media organization or media company? Like maybe we could build it, create a magazine or something like that. And so we started to look at, and around the same time, what started to happen was like the cost of digital video production really started to drop. All of a sudden, you could create something that could be go on a television that would look like the TV that you would be used to watching, but the production cost of the equipment to create something like that went from hundreds of thousands of dollars to thousands of dollars. And so all of a sudden it became kind of within reach of a normal person, maybe like a normal person running a business, to be able to create content that looked good enough to kind of be shown on a TV. And I always felt like one thing missing with sort of magazines and newspapers was when they would write about things like music or they'd write about things like fashion, you could never hear the music or you could never see things moving. There was this missing link there. And so we were like, well, what happens if we kind of created our own TV show and tried to kind of sell it into the networks, and it was like a youth-focused TV show and it was cool and edgy and whatnot. Then we sort of realized it'd be really hard to get a TV show up. So we started to look at other ways that we could distribute video content like that. And another friend of mine, Nick, who was working at a kind of another media agency, he was like, I saw these like real estate agency in Brisbane that would give out free DVDs in the mailbox. And we were talking about how that was an interesting concept, the fact that you could get DVD production down to the point where you could almost give them away for free. And so we sort of merged that idea with this idea of youth culture and content. And the initial product that was pedestrian was this DVD magazine that we would give away for free at clothing stores and universities and cafes and fashion shows and things like that. And people would pick them up, they'd take them home and they'd watch them on their DVD players, and it would run like this 1 hour TV show. It's similar to those kind of free magazines that people would sort of pick up. We would distribute this DVD and we would have sort of sponsors in the content and sponsors throughout. So that was the initial idea, and that was pedestrian for the first kind of couple of years. It was this free DVD magazine. We'd go out, we'd shoot all the interviews with kind of touring artists that were traveling into sort of Australia. We did a bit of travel for it as well. Went over to London and Hong Kong and shot some kind of footage all around the world. And we'd take our video cameras when we were traveling, and we'd shoot content in Sweden or Switzerland, like all these kind of far-flung places around the world. And we'd cut it together and edit it together and then put it out into the world. And we had like interviews with some really interesting bands and artists, like before they kind of became as famous as they are today and whatnot. And that was that was kind of how pedestrian started and the initial idea.
That's so interesting hearing you talk about video, because today in 2025, video is so central to every company.
Yeah.
20 years ago, I assume it wasn't that. Because what was the medium to distribute video back then? There was no, I mean, people had computers, but there was no shared social networks, right?
No, not really. So interestingly, I think pedestrian and YouTube both launched in the same month. I always argue that maybe like our insight that there wasn't enough niche video content out there could have led us to the same insight to launch YouTube, but I didn't do that. But we did okay. It was, So YouTube launched, but I mean, it was years before YouTube became kind of what it is today. It was sort of just a repository for funny pet videos and things like that for probably first 4 or 5 years of its existence, and that obviously has turned into something that's probably going to replace TV if it hasn't already.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned video, you mentioned the magazine. I was listening to a bunch of your interviews prior to this, and I went back to the early days of you when you were wearing suits and you'd rock up to your meeting, your interviews. And one of the reflections you shared was building the website in 2007-08. And you talked about how critical that was for distribution, and you feel that was a changing point when you reflect back. Can you share why that is? Because today websites are such a basic necessity for any business. You kind of start with a website and then build a product. Well, it sounds like for you, you built a website second, because back then websites were still up and coming. How did a website unlock that product market fit, if that's what you want to use?
Yeah, I mean, the wild thing to think about is, like, back then, the media agency, for instance, that we were at, that we left to go to production, there was one guy, one digital guy. Right. So everything that the agency was doing at that stage that was digital had to go through this one guy. Like, he had a special office. I think he'd worked in America. And so digital, even though it doesn't feel like that long ago, it's 20 years ago, digital in terms of kind of the way it operated within business was very nascent. So to your point, like, it was not uncommon for a business to have no online presence. So we pretty much got by with Pedestrian just by going out and presenting what we were doing. And the website was more just a landing page telling people, oh, it's a DVD magazine. So around 2007, we were starting to see that, okay, people are starting to go online to get their news, to get their information. We've got this brand. We are a kind of news-based service, but we only come out once every 2 months. So you can only be so, you can't really report on breaking news or interesting things that are happening. And so we decided to sort of launch this website in 2007 that would then deliver sort of up to the minute news around sort of popular culture. And that, yeah, that was a real pivotal point for the business, because for the first time, we weren't having to go out there and explain how the medium worked. So with Pedestrian as a DVD magazine, we were always explaining what the hell a DVD magazine was, but then having to explain why the Pedestrian brand is a brand fit for their brand to kind of advertise with us. Whereas with the website, people knew that a younger audience was starting to go, was spending time online, they were spending time on websites. And so then we just needed to convince people that Pedestrian was the right brand for them to work with. And so things all of a sudden got a lot easier for us when it came time to sort of try to get advertisers over the line. It wasn't ever like incredibly easy, but it was definitely easier than trying to sell a DVD magazine product. We sort of saw that all the brands that were wanting to target younger people were starting to shift their dollars into digital channels. And we were sort of one of the beneficiaries of that.
Well, I mean, I'd say it's similar to podcasts today, right? Where you need an audience and then the advertisers come, and we've got a bunch of sponsors on this show. I'm curious, like, you could almost call it a marketplace model where you need the magazine sense of readers and then those advertisers want to reach those readers. How did you attract both those stakeholders at the same time, the advertisers and the readers?
Yeah, correct. So I think on the reader's front, the way I view media is just consistency. People need to know what to expect from you, and you need to deliver that to them hundreds or thousands of times. With Pedestrian, it was pop culture news that covered everything from the highbrow to the lowbrow, delivered in a humorous, sort of easily accessible package that would make people laugh and give people a reason to sort of engage with the news cycle. And we would publish probably back then maybe 30 stories a day around that, 30 to 50 stories a day. And every single one of those stories had to kind of hit this mark. If you start to kind of have some things that don't, then you stop kind of getting that, creating that behavior, that habit with the readers. And so that's how I think you build audience, is you just have to be consistently good constantly. And so it's the same of a podcast. It's the same of a TV show. You just need to kind of constantly keep this up, because it's very easy for people to break the habit. Mm-hmm. But once you build a habit, it's very hard for people to get out of that. So that's how you build audience. In terms of how you build advertisers, in some ways it's easy once you have an audience. I think if you've got an audience that's undisputed and really hard to ignore, then advertising dollars will come. But I think it's also then how you package up your product. There's this difficult period when, as you're building up viewership and audience, where you don't have much audience, but you still need to fund the product. And that's where I think you need to get really creative, and you need to sort of really understand the target audience. You need to probably over-index in terms of how much work you're doing for the advertisers. If I had a podcast and I only had, say, 1,000 listeners, but I wanted to attract a big brand, I'd say, hey, like, why don't I create these kind of video in, like, these intros for my podcast where I talk about your brand, but we'll also then cut them so that you can use them independently on LinkedIn, or you can use them on other podcasts, or we'll do a case study on how we use your product to run our business as we scale. So you start to kind of solve other challenges for their business, which then offsets the fact that you haven't got that, you haven't got 100,000 listeners first because they can justify the spend.
Yeah, I think that's true with media today. It's funny, you said at the start, but it's come full circle where it sounds like 20 years later, the raw ingredients of a successful and enduring media company are probably still the same as they were when you started Pedestrian in 2005, one could say. So yeah. Go on.
No, I was just agreeing with you, yeah.
Okay. And when did you know you could make it into a big business? We'll talk about I think you sold a bunch to 9MSN, which was 2015, I believe. So one could say 10 years after you started. Now, 10 years is a long time. Like, we hear investors talk about startups take 10 years to return the fund and all that. One, I don't think you raised any external capital. Maybe you did. You can correct me. But two, when did you know that you could build this into a business, and was there a clear inflection point?
Yeah, look, so Pedestrian was bootstrapped largely because just back in 2004, 2005, I don't think anyone was talking about raising investment and VC funds and angels and all of that. That was very much a narrative that came probably almost 5 years later from when we started the business. So back then we just thought, oh, well, everyone starts a business by just starting out with a pool of savings that they invest into something, and then they build up their cash flow over time. We started with probably the smallest amount of money that you could probably start a business like that with, and then just saw it build and grow, and we had to be sort of profitable every single year. It was definitely a bit of a grind in those early days, and we were very much abusing that resource, which was just our time that we could put into the kind of business. It was just two of us for the first 18 months, and then we slowly started to kind of grow over that. And even by the time 10 years in, like, we were only about a team of 30 at around that point. But by the time we finally left, sort of 5 years after that, so 15 years into the journey, we'd grown to a team of about 100. But yeah, it was a pretty slow journey, which is partly because it was bootstrapped. We always had to have money in the bank to be able to pay people, and the money had to be generated from the business activities. I can definitely see the argument for VC funding kind of in businesses that have that sort of scalable opportunity. That said, I don't think the VC funding would have been the right path for Pedestrian, because we had a life-changing outcome. But if you look at, say, even the valuation that we got the first chunk of the business bought at, it's smaller than what some companies raise their seed rounds at in terms of evaluation, right? And that was 10 years into the journey, and it was quite a hard-fought sort of journey. But then getting the business to the point where it had more than like $1 million of EBITDA and like several million dollars of like revenue it was a 10-year journey to get to that point. So yeah, it was a very different journey to kind of maybe the one that we've gone about with Linkby. But I think I kind of always wanted to do something different with the second business.
Back to the episode in a moment. Let's talk about some of the most intimidating acronyms in business. ISO 27001. SOC 2. Essential 8. They sound like an alphabet soup, don't they? Trust me, I've been there. Vanta is like your business's compliance superpower. They automate the messy, mind-numbing parts of security monitoring, compliance tracking, and audit preparation. All of you as listeners of this podcast get a special offer. All you have to do is go to vanta.com/hi. That's vanta.com/hi. H-I-G-H. Or reach out to me via my email in the show notes. And that link, vanta.com/hi, is also in the show notes. Now, back to the episode.
I want to come back to Bootstrap versus VC and connected to LinkedIn in a moment, but people, I want to talk about people and team. You touched on that, and that came up. You connect me to Adrian, who's your co-founder now at LinkedIn, and I think you met him at Pedestrian, and even that's a funny story where I think he thought he wasn't performing and he thought he hadn't impressed you, and then he reached out. But that aside, one thing that everyone said is you're very good at spotting talent and you built a really good team. Even at LinkedIn, I think a lot of your leadership is ex-Pedestrian in Australia, but also overseas, which to me is a great sign that they clearly know you well enough to know your strengths and your weaknesses, and they're willing to go on that ride again, which is the best thing ever. And like, I'm sure you're very grateful. What was it about the way you spotted talent that allowed you to find those gems, and some of them have continued into your next business?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that I really love about company building is building teams. I feel like it's the closest I'll get to having my own sports team or something like that. And it's always sort of trying to find the people that fit certain roles or like things that you're lacking now that you kind of try to get with a new hire. I'm trying to make sure that every new hire takes you to a place that you haven't sort of been before and can kind of help you reimagine what the company could look like and have an impact on how the company sort of is shaped. So I think I love nothing more than sort of finding young talent that you can then sort of foster and that then turn into leadership level people within kind of your organization. So yeah, there's a number of people obviously Adrian, I worked with a Pedestrian and then tapped him on the shoulder when I was kind of devising the idea for LinkBee to kind of come on that journey with me as a co-founder. Meeting Andrew, my now LinkBee co-founder, when I first met Oscar, my Pedestrian co-founder, but then people like there's like Vanessa and Caitlin and Pete, people who are like part of the LinkBee leadership team now that started their career journey at Pedestrian. It is really wild, like seeing someone who you hired as a grad, then now leading a global sales team across the UK and the US is for like my second startup is quite wild. Yeah, it's something I really love. And I think it's something that still really excites me today. There's nothing I get a bigger buzz off of probably than when you finish an interview with someone and you're like, yep, they've got it. Like they're just, everyone else is playing here. They're playing over here. They're in a different realm. And you know that they're just going to add this sort of spark and all these opportunities that will then impact positively on everyone within the company.
Any specific, if you go tactical on that how you uncover that talent, where some people talk about the interview process, some talk about the case study, some talk about bringing someone in for a trial for a week and then see how they fit. And I know a lot of founders tell me, like, don't get swayed by logos. Look for potential rather than previous logos. I'm curious, you've done it twice now. What have you noticed with if you had to separate the ones that succeed and the ones that don't in your companies, what has been the tactical element and what have you reflected on in the interview process that made you confirm that instinct?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things. I mean, I could go on probably for an entire podcast around all of this. Look, I like people. Yeah, again, look, I don't think the logos are important. I'd rather actually get someone who has spent a number of years at a place that is more of a challenger brand. Like something like, say for a salesperson, I didn't think I would ever hire a salesperson from Google because the product is so great, it sells itself. So like salespeople at Google are not selling, they're just taking orders. Whereas if you go find someone and you go, God, like they've been at that place for 3 years, that product would be really hard to sell. And it could be, so a case in point, like Adrian came into our office to sell phone systems. So my co-founder in LinkBee walked into Pedestrian after a cold call and this guy walks in and he's selling me these things. And I'm like, I've never seen anyone sell a product harder. Like it was not in a, like a hard sales way, but just in this really elegant way where he really listened and connected the needs with the offering that they were giving. And so I said to him, well, have you ever considered a career change, like an industry change? Would you like to, we're hiring some roles at the moment. Do you want to come in and interview for these roles? And so his eyes lit up. He's like, yep, 100%, I'm there. And he'd never worked in the industry, but he was able to kind of pick it up so well because he had those core skills. So I think people who've done hard things in their career, kind of that's something I look for. I look for people who've done at least at least 2+ years in a role. I think there's a lot of people now that jump around from role to role after a year. And the thing is like, careers get hard at a certain point. Your job sometimes will, you'll face some adversity. And I think there's a type of person who the minute that happens, they just jump to another role. Whereas the people who are willing to kind of go on a journey with a company and just stick something out, and it doesn't have to be in every single role, but I think just someone who's had some type of longevity in a role means that there's a better than average chance that you'll be able to get that longevity out of them if you've built a kind of a company with a good culture and whatnot. We do timed sort of like real world style tasks through the interview process. We'll do things that kind of in some way echo the type of things that they'll have to do within their actual workday as part of our interview process. So say for hiring writers, we would give them like a time 2-hour task. Often they'd have to research a story themselves, find the story themselves, find the angle, and then sort of pitch it and actually create that content. We're adjusting a lot of those now as well in a world of AI to make sure that they're kind of to some degree AI proof as well. Yeah, kind of asking the right questions, making sure that you're not just like waiting for people to apply for roles, but you're actually reaching out to people that you think could be suitable for roles. Yeah, look, the list is endless, but it is something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, me too, which is why I was curious to unpack this, and maybe we can compare it to Link B, and we can jump around a bit here between Pedestrian and Link B. Is the difference you've made on this topic, where every founder that I've met who's been a second time founder after some success, they've gone with a very lean team the second time. I guess yours is different because you're bootstrapped, but all the founders that raised venture the first time or angel round of friends and family, the mistake they all have said to me is they wish they didn't hire such big teams. And with the second time, because I think that social validation doesn't come, where I always joke, like when you go to a party, people go, oh, how big is your team? Because it's a social validation metric, but it actually doesn't have any meaning behind it. Because just because you have a team of 20 doesn't mean you're earning revenue to cover the salaries of the 20 people and still have profit. It's just a rudimentary like metric. But curious, have you changed anything from your Pedestrian days as a manager and business leader to now in Link B? And can you share one or two specifics?
Yeah, definitely. The journeys are quite different because, as I said, Link B, we have raised outside capital. We're sort of just recently raised our Series B, whereas with Pedestrian, it was bootstrapped. So that said, Pedestrian, by the time I left at 100 people, we're still not there yet with Link B. I think we're around 80, just over 80 people. And so obviously the time it took us to get to that number, it was much quicker with Link B. But it, yeah, and I think I very much sort of hear what you're saying, but I think the interesting thing for me now is that it almost feels like there is an inverse actually, where it's like the new sort of sexy company is actually like, how much money can you make with as small a company as possible? There's this whole story of these $10 million per employee, like unicorns and whatnot. And so I quite like that. I like this sort of focus on efficiency. I think Linkby's always been a very cash efficient business, even though we have raised outside funding. But, you know, we've never been a business to just sort of burn mountains of cash in the hope of kind of getting to some sort of outcome. Like, we've always had this path to profitability built into what it is that we're building. And it's still that sort of bootstrap DNA is still very much with me. I think once you've run a bootstrap company, especially as we did for almost 15 years, you never lose that. I mean, some people might call that being tight, but I like to think it's about allocating dollars where they really need to be spent. And so we will, yeah, we're still very focused on making every dollar sort of stretch like it was coming out of my personal pocket. So, yeah.
And I think the most enduring companies are like that, where I think I say this to the VCs, where it's VC content marketing that's made us think that every company needs VC money and you need like bucket loads of VC money that you get drunk on. But actually, a lot of businesses actually, and a lot of the business fundamentals are, you talked about Procter & Gamble. I spent 9 years in FMCG and retail. Those companies are, the reason they've had, Procter's been around for a century is because they're very capital efficient businesses and they have amazing revenue growth and customer retention and profitability despite being a high capex business. Whereas we'll see if software businesses stay around for they've definitely done decades, but they do centuries. And I think your AI point is, yeah, really valid. I recently interviewed Eleanor Werner, who's the head of growth at Lovable. And she was saying they're doing $100 million and they've got a team of 30. Yeah. And the fastest growing company, and they've got $100 million in a year with a team of 30. Because I think a lot of that sales process is organic. And I think the power of the internet, like we talked to the earlier with the Pedestrian story, I think that is helping today, where the internet's distribution is so strong. And organic reach is so strong, where you don't need to, whereas you couldn't do that 20 years ago. So I think even ChatGPT is a good example, right? We're all connected to our phones. So getting that consumer reach happened because of the power of the internet.
Yeah, and I think it's also just the power of great products, really, where it's like a great product will spread incredibly quickly. The iPhone spread incredibly quickly. Great pieces of content travel. Great products now can travel at the sort of same velocity. Like, it's clearly these sort of AI products are kind of, there's a lot of excitement around them and they're drawing in a kind of audience really rapidly. But yeah, I do like that. I mean, I think that kind of a focus back on kind of efficiency is important. I think even for maybe like non-AI businesses that are growing at a more standard rate, I think if you really focus on, well, when do we get to profitability and how much money am I making per person? And is that number growing as we scale as opposed to dropping off? All of those type of metrics often aren't looked at as much as other ones that people sort of dream up to get out there.
Let's close up the pedestrian story and then spend some time on Linkby. So you said you did that tranche of the first sale, I think 60% in 2015 to Channel 9.
Right.
And the number I found was the valuation was 15 million around that number, which yeah. I think to your point is...
Yeah,
which, like, 15 and a half, which is...
No, it sounds like a cottage industry. Like, it now it sounds like we sold a cafe or something. Like, but the thing to remember is, like, in a bootstrap company...
That's a lot of money.
You can sell... Yeah, that's a decent amount of money. And this was 10 years ago or whatever. But, you know, it was enough to set ourselves up and our families and get something really significant out of this journey. And, yeah, and I mean, it's also, I think, having a little exit like that, you start to realize, like, what money does for you and what it doesn't do for you. And I think you'd be surprised how little money you need to just get rid of the inconveniences and kind of not cause more inconveniences for you.
Tell me more. I feel like you reflected on this, like, post the pedestrian sale. Tell me, what did you think life would have been?
I mean, look, like, when I was I think I remember when I was like 18 years old or whatever, and like, I was working a part-time job and I was at uni, I was like, being rich is just being able to put your car down and always knowing it's going to go through. And I still kind of feel like that's what it is today. It's just sort of knowing that you've got, it's not like constantly going after some never-ending goal of what your life can be like. You know what I mean? A private jet is not going to make you happy, or like owning an NBA team is not going to make you happy. It's just another thing. So really, it's about actually kind of going, do I love my life, and how do I just optimize for, if anything, it's about trying to take money away as a stressor. Because I think too little money, 100%, it's super stressful. Like, it breaks up marriages. It makes people kind of, it puts pressure on people that they shouldn't have to go through. But too much money also stresses people out and people go a bit kind of crazy the other way. So I think it's about just, you want to have enough where you can maintain a level at which you're happy for the rest of your life. That to me is just what it's about. And I think a lot of the decisions that we've probably made sort of post pedestrian sale and now, and even the way I view a lot of these things, I'm just like, how do I kind of maintain my quality of life moving forward and try to be, and try not to get sucked into this kind of need of, oh, I need this and I need that and whatnot. Yeah.
And it never ends. I haven't had the 100 million exit the way you've had, but I've got friends who have got wealthy, and I don't think it ever ends, right? Where new insecurities prop up and new comparisons prop up. So you never, like that joke, we have two private jets next to each other. You and I would look at that and go, wow, what a rich person. But that person looks at it and goes, why does the other person have a bigger private jet than me? And they're caught up in that race, whereas to the rest of the world is so wealthy. The fastest growing companies in history, like Figma, Ramp, OpenAI, and Cursor, are all built on Notion. Notion gives startups everything they need to move fast, stay lean, and scale smarter. It replaces 8+ tools like Trello, Confluence, and meeting note apps, saving founders and teams thousands and reducing chaos. Over 50% of the Y Combinator and 90% of the Forbes Cloud 100 companies use Notion to run everything from fundraising to hiring. And here's the best part. HighFlyers podcast listeners like you can get up to 6 months of the Notion business plan free, saving you up to $12,000. So if you're a founder or executive team member looking to move faster and stay focused, Notion is the place to build. Get that offer now at ntn.so/HighFlyers. That's ntn.so/high H-I-G-H, Flyers, F-L-Y-E-R-S. And now, back to the episode. But I am curious to ask you about family. We touched on it with your parents, but I think what's maybe a bit under, not as known about you is during pedestrian, you'd had two kids, right? Two or more kids. I don't know if you had more kids by the time you finished up pedestrian.
So I've got two kids, and I did have sort of my first child earlier than probably most people. Definitely kind of in, I suppose, Sydney maybe. So I had my first child when I was 26. So I met my wife, Sonia, when I was 23 years old, a couple of years after I'd sort of started pedestrian. I had my first child at 26, my second child at 29. I'm a reasonably young dad. My son's about to turn 16. My daughter's 13. They're both in high school.
It's so incredible. I would not have thought that when I met you, like just the way you carry yourself. Even I think in the research, everyone said you've got this ability where you still are very connected to society. Like you'll go out and hang out with people for dinner, or you'll be up to date with pop culture, but you've still got kids. And even your parents said, I think you still go for dinner on a Sunday night to their house. Or you try to go on Sundays. How do you do this all? Do you just not sleep and you just...
No, I mean, look, I think it's the Sunday night dinner thing. That's just a kind of non-negotiable, right? Family is so important. We're so fortunate to have my parents still with us and to have them within driving distance, going and seeing them every Sunday after everything they've done for me over my life. It's like the least I could possibly do. Plus, I enjoy their company and I like enjoy spending time with them. So it's easy and it's something that kind of I really cherish. I think in terms of everything else, staying connected to culture, like again, like to me, that's always just been such an important part of who I am and what I do and what I love. We are constantly buying tickets to concerts, comedy shows, like gigs, and I'll often try and buy an extra couple of tickets. So it kind of forces you to then go, oh, who are we going to invite? Which friend's going to come along to this thing with us? And yeah, all through my life, I think I've always been a social organizer, someone who likes bringing people together. And yeah, that's something that kind of still remains today, that I think I've got this sort of social battery that always needs to be charged. And so I like to have kind of people around me and make sure that I'm seeing people. And I think often I'll find if I'll have a little bit of a down moment, it's often just because I haven't seen friends and people kind of for a while. So yeah, it's a huge part of what I think contributes to that sort of happiness in life. And so it's something that I really try to kind of focus on.
So you've sold pedestrian, you've got the two kids, your wife, Sonia, who sounds awesome. Where were you at this point in life? And this was 2018, 19, if my numbers are correct, right?
Yeah. So we did the first chunk of the sale in 2015. We sold the rest of the business in 2018. And then we had about a year of helping the business sort of transition through succession planning. And then we walked out the doors for the last time in 2019.
So at that point, you could have become an angel investor, you could have become an advisor, you could have started doing content and being an influencer. You probably had a lot of people reaching out to you. Tell me how did that lead to LinkB? And I guess, why did you want to go at it again? Because we just talked about the grind you did for 10 years with pedestrian. You've now got two kids that are growing up. I'm sure you and Sonia sat down and you're like, do we want to do this again? Or do we just take a simpler life? Connect the dots from leaving pedestrian to LinkB.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just really enjoy it. I've always been entrepreneurial. I've always had these little, I just love building things and especially like creating companies and products that just have never been done before and putting them out in the world. I don't think I would ever launch a copycat business. I don't think I'd ever launch a business where I look at, say, a business in the US that's doing real well and go, oh, I'm just going to do the Australian version of that. That type of thing never interests me, but like creating something, you know, that's unique and different, that hasn't been done before, or like taking things that haven't been put together in a certain way and then bringing them to life is something that really excites me. The idea for LinkB really came from the journey at pedestrian. I was looking at the way that smaller brands could work with us, and there just was no way that a D2C brand could come to us and kind of buy content placements on a kind of performance basis. And there was all these amazing brands being launched in Australia, Koala Mattresses or like Modi Body and things like that. And knowing that we really had no way to work with these brands that were starting to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars on Facebook just seemed kind of crazy. And so I sort of thought, well, if I can crack this, then not only does it help a whole lot of like entrepreneurs and founders to kind of help tell the stories of their businesses, which I think is incredibly important, but it also helps publishers and kind of newsletters and creators and people like that to be able to better monetize their products, which I think is incredibly important as well. I think finding sustainable revenue for media is something that is a ongoing challenge for those businesses. And I think we've really kind of unlocked it with Linkby. The publishers that are embracing Linkby are seeing huge wins in the tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars of revenue per month and like growth rates that look like the type of growth rates that a business like Pedestrian was experiencing at the very peak of Facebook sharing. Yeah. Like,
can you unpack the bare bones of how that works? I mean, Adrian said you're a genius. He called you a genius. I'm definitely not a genius. So to a layman like me, can you unpack how Linkby works in its bare bones?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Linkby works very similar to if you've bought a Facebook ad, it's almost like buying a Facebook ad, but for connecting brands to the content on a publisher site. If a brand wants to get featured on a website like Pedestrian, or they want to get featured on a website like USA Today in the US, or a website like the Daily Mail in the UK, they can use the Linkby platform, come to it, they put in a brief similar to a press release, and then they choose which publishers they want to pitch that to. They also choose their budget and a CPC that they're willing to pay. The publishers-
CPC being cost per click. Yeah.
So the publishers go away, they create content. So it's original content around that brand. And then the brand just pays for every click that just, every person that comes through via a click to their website. So if you're a brand, it gives you kind of what you really want, which is you want a publisher talking about your product. It's great for telling your brand story. It's great for building trust. It's great for now appearing in ChatGPT type prompts and things like that, because a lot of the stories that we're helping to facilitate for brands are now showing up as citations. So it delivers all these benefits, but you can actually now measure it with and pay for it on a cost per click basis, on a performance basis. And so that's something that just didn't exist before. You were not able to buy those content placements on a cost per click basis. And so it's driving new revenue for publishers as well as a new advertising channel for brands. And but yeah, now operating all over the globe.
And is that a busy space where, let's say our brand, like High Flyers, if we had to go out and choose, is there Linkby and is there a whole bunch of other options that we can pick from?
Not in the kind of format that we've put it together. There's right. A lot of people out there to help kind of media try to monetize, but a lot of them have always focused around more traditional advertising units. There's a lot of people playing in like display advertising, kind of putting banner ads around the place, but this is actual content mentions. And in that space, there's not a whole lot of people working. So yeah, look, so far it feels like it's pretty sort of clear, sort of like ahead. And I think we've executed really well that I think it would be hard for a competitor to come and sort of completely try to play in the space. But there are like a lot of people on the periphery that do somewhat similar things, but in different ways.
I know you're one of the investors, OIF, really well. Like I know the team, they've known them for years. And they mentioned that from the start, you had like really good traction and you were profitable, low burn. I think you were doing 100K a month when they met you in the early days, potentially. And yeah, you grew from like 400 to 1,500 advertisers. Again, the numbers might be off a bit. And what do you put that down to in the early days? Was it that Pedestrian lived experience and earned insight? Or was it something else in the early days that allowed you to get that traction?
I think being a second-time founder helps because you know exactly kind of which levers you need to pull and, you know, what you need to invest in. It's a much clearer picture because you kind of in business, you're constantly coming to these forks in the road and you need to get left or you need to go right. But if you've gone down that journey before, those decisions become a lot easier than the first time you're doing it. So I think that helped a lot. But it also just came from just really knowing what the core fundamentals were for the business. And we heavily invested in something like sales, which is very unsexy in the world of tech because everything should be product-led. But I knew that if I get a salesperson in, they'll be able to get the product in front of X amount of people every week. And the product seemed to make sense to people the minute we presented it to them. So we have a really high close and conversion rate. So it just became a bit of a numbers game. It's like sort of knowing what your numbers are and knowing what the inputs and outputs that you want to get off of the back of that is. And then essentially just getting those in and scaling them up is kind of what it came back to, and being really single-minded on that, not getting distracted. I think the challenge for entrepreneurial people with that mindset is that you want to do so many different things, one of the actual superpowers is knowing when you're onto a good thing, knowing to sort of say no to things and really kind of laser focus on the problem that you're solving better than anyone else.
I'm smiling because that came up in my research. People said, you're very optimistic. Like sometimes you'll go down a path. Like I think someone said to me with a pedestrian, he wanted to build a jobs channel at one point, and you were like really annoyed that he couldn't get to Seek, get bigger than Seek. You're like, why is this not working? And again, I'm similar to you in that. Like my partner, Jo, she's a doctor, and she's like, how are you just so optimistic? Like you're just going to find a way. I'm like, I'm going to find a way. And some people can call that arrogance. I call that no, just brute determination. And sometimes it blows up in our face. That's fine. That's, I think, the feature of being an entrepreneur. But I am curious on that. I was listening to one of your recent interviews, and you talked about a term, GEO, Generative Engine Optimization.
Yeah.
And I think you predicted that it could become central to marketing as SEO once was. And it's a question that everyone's trying to answer in 2025. Curious, again, this is a fluid question and it might change next year. So that with that disclaimer, how do you think, like what is the advice you're giving to your customers or people that are coming and reaching out to you on this topic?
Yeah, so I mean, generative engine optimization is essentially how you appear when people are searching for your brand or around the type of prompts that might have your brand appear on tools like ChatGPT or Perplexity or Claude. So it's this new world of answer-based search. So look, some of the basics cross over a lot with SEO. I think, you know, brands that have strong SEO strategies and strong owned and operated content strategies will be doing better than most brands that don't within that space. But I think one area where we've seen brands really win is that LinkBee's been able to help get brands significant amounts of coverage across a whole lot of other trusted voices and publications across the web. And these sources are appearing really highly as citations for a lot of queries and prompts that people are putting into platforms like ChatGPT. We have a brand that we recently worked with, a sunscreen brand in the US, I think actually owned by Procter & Gamble, interestingly enough. And we ran a huge amount of content for them. I think it was about 40 pieces of content in about a week. And even a few weeks later, when someone was typing in best sunscreen in the US, articles that we'd created were coming up as the citation for L2MD, which was the brand that we were kind of working with. Or we have a teeth whitening brand that we work with in the UK that regularly, like when you type it into best teeth whitening at home teeth whitening kits, it's coming up and the citations are all being driven from articles that they've driven through the LinkBee platform. So I think this idea of the value of content and the value of placements outside of your own ecosystem, that's where LinkBee really helps brands deliver phenomenal results. And if you think about how much time you're spending in your life now where a question that previously you would have typed straight into Google is now starting to go into ChatGPT, or an answer that you're putting into Google is now coming back with a text-based sort of AI-based response as opposed to a list of links. It's starting to shift to probably almost kind of 50% plus of search, if not, and it most likely will get sort of, I think, 80 to 90% of search. It's something that we're able to have a huge impact for brands, and it's another additional benefit that LinkBee can drive beyond the sort of standard performance PR work that can be measured on a cost per click basis.
Yeah. I think you said earlier about Reddit and Quora. Those are really interesting how those businesses are so relevant today because of that crowdsourced trust first model where it's humans vouching for a brand or a software or a product. I've been using it recently with, I think, a good use case of credit cards. When you're trying to find credit cards, it's such a painful experience trying to find them, but AI has this wonderful ability to find those like Whirlpool Reddit groups that folks are talking about credit cards and talking about the catch and talking about whatever. And I think that's going to make it really interesting for like comparison websites as well. Like I think everyone's, the jury's out on what happens to all these brands where even I think a lot of startups now started putting case studies. You talked about case studies earlier on their website, which I think the AI crawlers are crawling. But I am curious on the crawlers, like there's a big topic at the moment about the publishers versus the AI industry. Like it's a very live conversation in Australia with the government. It's a live conversation. I think Cloudflare came out a couple of months ago and said, we're going to block all these crawlers. And recently there's been a controversy with Perplexity where they're doing a few things. Again, neither you and I know the answers, like time will tell. But you're an actor in the ecosystem. You've got a voice. How do you think about it? What is your message to publishers who are, or even creators who are paranoid going that they're going to lose, they won't make money off it because they just get the content gets stolen essentially?
Yeah, it's a difficult situation. I think that copyright needs to be valued. I'm not one of the people within the tech ecosystem that says we should tear down all copyright because it's slowing the speed of innovation. But to me, if you're a musician or an artist or a writer and you're creating valuable information, it shouldn't be allowed to be just ingested and then essentially kind of spat back out in some format to kind of, in a way that can devalue your work directly. Like I don't agree with that at all. But I do think that there's an opportunity clearly around like everything that's happening in the AI space. And I think that fighting against things doesn't always get you the best result. That I think the intelligent publishers will be looking at like, how can I monetize this opportunity that's sort of sitting in front of me? Like, how do I do deals with kind of AI companies? How do I kind of monetize this content that I'm sitting on? How do I help brands to solve for like the generative engine optimization challenges that they're having and kind of work with them and offer that as a kind of benefit of working with us because of the way that the content can then get picked up? So I think that just fighting back against what's new is never a great strategy. A lot of the success that we had at Pedestrian was really riding the wave of new technology as it came in. It was just the novel concept of a daily newsletter. It was something that like no one was doing in the youth space. And we sort of jumped on that and started doing that. And that was a huge growth curve for us. Novel forms of, we started to get great traction through Google News, like when that first launched. And so that was a real driver for the business. Then there was when the Facebook algorithm was going off. We even did some work with MySpace before Facebook. It was always kind of going where the audience is, riding each wave and finding how we can monetize off the back of that. So if I was, I think, a publisher today, rather than spending maybe that time fighting against it, I would be going, how do I actually monetize this opportunity? Because there's things that I can do that brands can't. And if I find that intersection point of where I sit, then that's something I'll be able to kind of sell back to brands and monetize. And I think that's something that I'm not seeing enough of.
Yeah, maybe it'll start to change with time, because I think there's also fear of just, we talked earlier at the start about like identity, right? Fear of the unknown. I think that's probably in this world as well. I want to ask a couple of other lengthy questions and then we can wrap with a rapid fire sprint. I think the other aspect that's interesting with your setup with the co-founders that perhaps people won't know about is you're a distributed team globally now, where Adrian's, I think, moving to New York this week we're recording. Or is you,
literally you flew out on Saturday. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You just flew out recently and Andrew's now living in Hong Kong and in your Sydney based. And I spoke to both of them in the lead up to this and they actually said it works very well because you do less founder meetings compared to like other companies and you have a really good relationship where you don't need to be explaining something to each other and you can make decisions. And I think again, back to the respect they have for you and you have for them, it seems like there's a really good marriage there where no one's really watching over their back. Any traits there, like any things that you've picked up on like good founder relationships? You've done it with Pedestrian and now you're doing it at Linkby. The difference being you've got two co-founders now, but you're also venture-backed, whereas Pedestrian, you had one co-founder and you were bootstrapped.
Yeah, I think having clear lines of responsibility and clear, it helps a lot. I think one thing that we could have probably done better at Pedestrian was that we sort of ended up sitting on top of each other a lot. Pedestrian, I guess we were sort of co-MDs or co-CEOs. I think that's difficult. So we were 50-50, we had a great kind of experience building the business, but there were times when there was tension. And I think at times that tension was caused by the fact that there was no one who clearly owned different parts of the business. And there probably wasn't maybe like inherent and complete, therefore, trust in those areas. Whereas I think with Linkby, the thing that's working really well is that I do have like complete trust in our leaders and like my co-founders to do their part of the business better than I could do it. And so that is really, that sort of autonomy works well for me, it works well for them. And that is, I think, the maybe the secret to it is sometimes that co-founder relationship, and you see it a lot, there's no real delineation between what's your skill set and what's the other person's skill set. Having that sort of clear, Andrew leads tech and product and Adrian leads revenue, and now he's going to be going over to the US to help us continue to grow Link B in that market. That's what I think is working really well. And we get on really well. We're all pointed in the same direction and heading there. And it's great. And I mean, I look back on those kind of business relationships and incredibly fondly. Oscar at Pedestrian, we're still friends today. And we went through this phenomenal journey of building this business. And we had our ups and our downs. But like, for the most part, it was like these just surreal moment after surreal moment, culminating in this great outcome with a sale to Channel 9, and now going on the journey with Adrian and Andrew. It's incredibly special, and I think it would be really lonely doing it without them, right? Because having those people that are like this sort of band of brothers type vibe, where you're going through these the ups and the downs and stuff like that together, it's really cool.
Agreed. And they just seem like good guys. I do a lot of the research calls for podcasts, and often it's a call just about the guest and they wrap up there. Whereas Adrian and Andrew, I feel like we're just chatting about life and we'd never met before. Like, Andrew and I had a very deep chat about like culture and Asian philosophies. And I think he was saying like he comes from a very different philosophy to the Western world. Like, he believes in slow and thoughtful and considered, which was nice to learn about. I want to ask about your life co-founder, and then we can go to Rapidfire Sprint, Sonia. I mean, she's been with you through Pedestrian and Link B, and we haven't really touched on her. Do you want to, and she pretends she's one of those like high flyers who doesn't get the credit, like she doesn't have a public profile like you do. Do you want to talk about what you've learned from her and the influence she's had on your journey?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, me and Sonia now have been together for almost 20 years. And when we first met, she was earning more than me. I was basically like just sort of moved myself into apartment. And like,
even the story of how you met was hilarious. Like, she told me the DJ that you were DJing and you were not the best DJ, but she stuck with it, and then things happened. So yeah.
DJing is not one of my, it's maybe like indicative of kind of the level of hustle that we had, that to help fund the early days of Pedestrian with throw parties, and then it was cheaper sometimes for us to DJ than to book DJs, so we would just sort of play music. I think we could curate music really well, but we couldn't mix it particularly well.
I've heard you're a good dancer though, so I think you make up for it there.
Yeah, I can carve up a dance floor. So yeah, she's amazing. She's been a fantastic life partner. She's amazing with the kids. She's a brilliant writer. She's super creative in her own right. She kind of moonlights as like a management consultant for all my like different ventures, and she's really kind of hearing me out, and then when I need the advice, she always kind of nails it with the right kind of course of actions. Yeah, she's been brilliant. And I think just kind of knowing that she's known me from when there was like two people at Pedestrian and the thing could have fallen apart at any time, and then now being able to kind of build this life together around and having her there to kind of support me on the journey is awesome.
Go, Sonia, for sure. Definitely a high flyer in every way. Yeah. Let's move to Rapid Fire Sprint to close us out. Is there one non-work investment, so a course or a holiday that you've invested in that you consider the best?
So we kind of touched on this like a little bit earlier in the podcast and the chat, but I would say like the investment in tickets and experiences. We are constantly like, anytime I see like a concert or an artist that, even artists that sometimes I just look interesting, I'll buy those tickets. So we love going to comedy, or we love going to exhibitions. And I think the more of that you do, it helps to fuel your creativity. It helps to fuel your worldview. But it's also just something really fun to do in your life to kind of break out of the norm. And I think especially when you have kids, like life can become like a bit monotonous, and you start to forget who you are amongst all your roles and responsibilities. So yeah, doing that, I think if you have the means to buy some extra tickets and to things, and then invite friends along as a way to kind of make sure that you're kind of keeping up those relationships as well. I know a lot of founders who just go dive straight into their startups and they don't see they lose personal connections and networks. And I think that's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Could not agree more. And I think a good reminder for me. One interview question you love asking prospective candidates in a hiring process?
In the job interview sort of process?
Yeah, in a hiring process, yeah.
One question I've always really liked is, what's something that we can do better? I'd ask that at Pedestrian, I'd ask that at Link B, and I thought it was an interesting question because it's a hard thing to deliver because it's them often delivering feedback to you. And so seeing how someone can deliver feedback or deliver a Facebook message is an interesting insight. And then also whether they actually give you like their level of research that they've done on you to kind of tell you what you can do better. It means they really need to know what you do and how you do it and their experience of you. And I sort of say it could be around anything. It could be around the interview process. It could be about like what you've seen of the business so far. And and you always get really interesting insights. And then it also means that the worst thing that happens out of that interview, even if you don't end up going forward with that candidate, is you've gotten some user feedback that you can then use to kind of improve the product. Mm.
I feel like I should ask you that now. What can I do better, Chris, as a host?
Wow.
I mean, what have I not done in this interview that you wish I did?
I mean, what I love that you do is the level of research is phenomenal. It was always something I really prided myself on at Pedestrian. I was like, I want to have the best researched interviews that I possibly can because it does mean right. You get so much more out of people.
Yeah.
What could you do better? I would say, I think like you could maybe work on, I love that image of the plane, and I don't know what that is, but I think I want to see more in the background. I want to see like a curated kind of background with like interesting things that speak to the High Flyers episode. Maybe you can ask like every High Flyer to send you something funny, unique about them or something like that, and you collect it all, like the best ones. I don't know. That's what I think. One of the things we do with new hires, because we are predominantly remote based around sort of certain geographic hubs, is that we have a $500 that they can spend on their work from home setup. And a lot of them actually spend it on plants for the background and this and that, just to kind of create a better sort of backdrop to their calls.
Yeah, that's a good reminder, Chris, to do that. And that picture of the plane actually is, I took it from a plane window flying over Queenstown in New Zealand.
Amazing, yeah.
So that's an iPhone photo that I got enlarged, and it actually had nothing to do with the podcast, but it connects now because High Flyers flying airplanes. So people probably think I'm like some airplane fanatic, but I have never been interested by airplanes, so it's just a random mix. But no, that's a good feedback. I will get on that, and hopefully next time we chat, I've got a better. Yeah, I like it. Last one, what's the kindest thing someone's done for you?
Look, I think the kindest thing that someone's done for me is probably just like my parents sort of bringing me up in Australia and like supporting all my life and career choices, even though they were quite different to the framework that they had. I think I remember being at school and I had other friends who were from a similar kind of immigrant backgrounds, and it was like their parents were trying to raise little Sri Lankan kids in Australia or little, you know, Italian kids in Australia, as opposed to my parents who were, well, we're in Australia, so Chris is making choices that an Australian kid would make, and they sort of just gave me the freedom to explore and find my way and without being too kind of overbearing or too strict and things like that. And I think that to me feels like kindness in that it's something that would have challenged them and probably put them out a little bit, but like they approached it with such love and support that it was really formative for who I became.
Nice one. And I know for a fact they're very proud of you. Like they were very nice in the research and they wrote me. I actually got very emotional reading that because I was like, that is so nice that they took time out and did that. And just, it was very genuine. You know how like sometimes you get research back, like particularly when it's written research, you can tell the guest has interfered with that process and given that person some comments and be like, tell them about this. But yeah, I could tell your parents like wrote it so genuinely because they took the mickey out of you in some areas. And I think I asked you some of it at the start and then others. You know, that actually made me emotional. I think I had a few tears reading through that because I was like, I wonder what my parents would say if someone asked them to do that piece of research on me.
Well, we might have to flip this around, Vid, and I might have to talk to you about you, and then I'll get the research done. And then
maybe episode 250, I'll flip it and you can interview me and you can speak to my parents and my partner, and then we can compare notes.
Let's do it. Yeah. I do really love that interview process and doing the research. It's something that's always, like a pedestrian, I'd always, you know, before we'd interview people, I'd sort of like text people I knew that knew them, and I'd get research and like I'd get these funny questions to answer them, and always got some really hilarious stuff through that.
It's my favorite part of doing it. It's a lot of work, but I love it. But on that note, we have come to a finish. Chris, thank you so much, and huge congrats on where you're at, and chat soon.
Awesome, thanks so much, Vidit, really appreciate it, and thank you for having me on.
That's a wrap. So if something in this episode sparked a thought, send it to a friend or colleague. And if you're curious about partnering with us and the Curiosity Center, whether it's this podcast, to our reports, events, and more, and join the ranks of existing commercial partners, including Google, KPMG, Vanta, the University of Melbourne, and others. My details are in the show notes. Until next time, I'm Vidit Agarwal, and this is the High Flies Podcast.